Welcome to Law in the Bush, a regional, rural, remote podcast by the University of New England's Law School.
Don't forget to enter our competition to win a prize. Tell us your favourite episode and why, or just email us or see the episode description for more details. Welcome to the show. We've got Paul Akon from the Law School with us. Welcome, Paul.
Nice to be here, Lisa.
Some of the units you teach remedies and advanced legal skills, which colloquially at the law school we call moot, where students have to present a case in court and stand up and present to judges. How do students find that?
The students call it moot. The law school calls it advocacy. Historically, it's been known as one of the most difficult subjects that students undertake in their whole law degree. Many of them become very anxious about it, really unnecessarily in a sense, because we train them well and the pass mark in advocacy is very high. It's just the anxiety that people have, and I can remember having the same anxiety when I first got up in court. I can still remember the courtroom in Hospital Road in Sydney, and I only had to mention a matter before a district court judge, and I was trembling. I can remember that. So I can understand the anxiety, but we try to allay that with a lot of good workshops and a lot of good resources by encouraging students to adopt the mantra of that particular module, which is very simple. It's got three parts: preparation, preparation, preparation. If you do your preparation, you usually don't have any problems with it. A lot of the students tell us, by way of feedback, that when they go to do their practical legal training, because you have to do moots there also, Sandstone students, graduates from the Sandstone University, say to them, "Where did you learn that?" And they say, they puff their chests out, and we said, "I learned it at UNE," because a lot of the Sandstones don't have it as a compulsory unit. The Law Society and the Law Council are very pleased that we have it as a compulsory unit because they think it's an essential part of the practice of law. For instance, not only in court. An example was given yesterday at the orientation day about one of our students who's now a very highly placed advisor and policymaker for a minister of government in Victoria. Now, she has our degree. She's done advocacy. She has to, around a table, sometimes advocate for the policy changes that she wants, all exactly the same principles that we learn in our advocacy module here in preparation for the moot. So it is an important aspect.
Because you've been a lawyer, and now you're a law lecturer, how did that work together and do you miss being a lawyer?
I've worked in both public and private practice. And one of the things I would say is that the Americans do it better than us in this regard. They have what they call secondments, crossover secondments, where people go from the civil service into private practice and from private practice into civil service for 6 or 12 months on secondment. If you ever get an opportunity to do that, take it with both hands. Because I found when I went into the civil service in police legal services, having practiced at that stage for some 30 years in the private sector, I had a very jaundiced view of what it would be like. And it was absolutely fantastic. I learnt so much. And there's some very, very good lawyers in the civil service. No doubt about
that. And
so,
and you were in the police department?
Police legal services, yes, at headquarters. So I was lucky from that point of view. My wife got a job up here at Armidale, so I came up here with her in 2006. I was doing a locum for Aboriginal Legal Service, and I got a call from the university say, "We heard you're in town and you've got experience in mediation, and would you be interested in teaching?" And I said yes, and that's how it started. So I started teaching Law 157, which is alternative dispute resolution, and then something else came up, and now they can't get rid of me. 15 years.
We're very lucky to have you because students, of course, really enjoy learning about law from you because you've got that practitioner background. Now, what advice would you give to students when they've just graduated who want to practice or move into being an academic? I mean, if they are from a rural area.
You've obviously got to prepare your CV as best you can, and you can get help on that. And it's good to target your CV for the particular job that you're applying for. So if you're applying for a job where a firm does mainly litigation, well, target all the good things you've done in litigation, including Law 480 and advocacy and things like that. And research is a big thing too. Emphasize that you've done research, because not many other law schools do advanced legal research, is what we do here at the UNE. And while you're doing all of that, use your network, use your family. There's usually somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody that knows a solicitor. And you've just got to be a bit bolshy. You've got to be upfront, and you've got to go and ask them. And this is the big cruncher. You've got to be prepared, in my view, to do some voluntary work to start with. Even if it's just photocopying, deliveries and things like that, just to get your foot in the door.
Move. I know I had a friend in Canberra and he refused to move, but everyone else I studied with at UNE was prepared to move around New South Wales and they all got work.
Exactly, exactly. And there's more work available in the country. When I was in practice out at Forbes for 20 odd years, we had a lot of trouble getting people to come out there. And we had to pay a premium, actually. You pay more money for the new graduates out there than you do in the city. So be prepared to move. I think that's a very good piece of advice. Go down. Legal aid are always stretched for resources. Aboriginal Legal Service even more so. Offer yourself to do voluntary work. That's one way that I think is a really important way to start.
And there's community legal centres too.
Community legal centres, exactly, are the same sort of thing. And they also do a lot of mediation too, depending where they are. And let me give you a couple of examples. There was a young bloke that was working. He couldn't get his job as a graduate lawyer. He was working in a childcare centre. I'd never heard it before, but he was working in a childcare centre. And on the weekends, he was working for 40 Winks. Now, 40 Winks, for those of you that don't know, they provide bedding, mattresses and mattress bases and one thing or another. He went to this house on the North Shore one Saturday with his truck and his mate, and they unloaded this double bed and base and took the old one out and put. And as often happens, even though it wasn't part of the deal, the people at the house, the guy at the house said, could you assemble it for us? And they said, oh, okay. So they assembled it. They could do that in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, whereas it would have taken the bloke. And it emerged that this guy was a retired lawyer. And the chap that was looking for a job remembered his name because it was the name of a firm to which he'd applied for a job recently. And he just got the standard form reply saying, yes, we've got your application. We've got nothing at the moment. We'll put it on file. And if we have anything come up, we'll get in touch with you. So after they'd finished the job and loaded the old mattress back on the truck and one thing and another, he got in the truck and he texted the bloke in the house and he said, are you from such and such a firm of lawyers? Because your name is in that. He said, yes, I am. I used to be the senior partner. I'm now retired. As I said, he said, well, I applied to your firm a couple of months ago for a job and I got the standard, you know, reply from HR. Could you help me? And the bloke said, yes. And the young fella sent him his CV. And within 24 hours, he got a CC email where the retired lawyer had emailed his old firm and said, this young fella just delivered a bed to my home. He looks like he's got a bit of go in him. I think you should give him an interview. A few hours later, he got a phone call from HR, and HR said, you got friends in high places, we believe. He went for the interview, and the rest is history. He got the job, and you've got to use your initiative, every possible contact you've got.
And firms like that people do voluntary work, and in fact, people do that once they are working as a lawyer as well.
We've got to do pro bono, yeah. But in America, they have a system, which I think is a good system, where you're obliged, I think, to do 10% pro bono. I think it's voluntary here at the moment, but most big firms, as you say, do pro bono.
And for our listeners who don't know what pro bono is, could you explain that?
Well, it comes from the Latin for nothing, basically. It means for good. You're doing it for the good of doing it and not for money. So it's used in legal circles for doing voluntary work. And most lawyers do some sort of voluntary work. They don't record it or tabulate it the way they have to in America, but you'll find, as Lisa says, they are doing it all through their careers.
So, for instance, when refugees are appealing against decisions, and of course, refugees don't have the money to pay. So, you know, those sort of cases and much, much more.
You're listening to Law in the Bush, a law research series about regional, rural, remote law by the University of New England.
You've had so much experience as a practitioner and with teaching lots of units at the law school and helping students understand what law's about. And you've also done a lot of stuff to do with crime and rural crime. Where would you like to start?
I'll probably start with one of my great mentors, a barrister called Jack Mader. And he said to me very early on in my legal career as a graduate lawyer, don't get too close to your clients, but don't also get too far away from them. You've got to determine or work out this ability to be empathic towards your client, but not too close. Sympathetic, empathetic. And one of the examples I can give is in relation to lawyers that often work for gangsters. They get too close to their clients, and their clients then have a power over them. And the example recently of the Melbourne solicitor who did a lot of work for the gangsters down there, who went out the back of his office to have a cigarette, and a car went past and he was shot in the head. If you want to do criminal law, you can act for Legal Aid. It's a great training ground for lawyers. Many, many of the best lawyers have come out of Legal Aid. There's the Aboriginal Legal Service. They're in the defence teams, obviously. And then you can act for the DPP. You can become a prosecutor. You can go to the Crown Solicitor's Office. There's many, many areas where you can practice criminal law, which fascinates students. But whatever you do, don't act for gangsters. Going back now to a rural case, which was, in many respects, you ask for a memorable case, it was all over a bail hook. And a bail hook is something that they use when they're loading hay onto trucks and trailers. They pick these, they hold them in their hands, and they put the hook into the bales, and it enables loading without damaging the hands. And there was a feud going on between these two families. And one family alleged that the other family had, quote, stolen, unquote, one of their bail hooks. And this escalated into a situation where we had to finish up in court to argue over this bail hook. This went for a day in the local court. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Can I ask really how much a hook costs?
Oh, in those days, probably $10.
So maybe that would be the equivalent of $30 now?
Perhaps.
Okay.
But also what was fascinating about it was it gave you an example, an insight into how lawyers can get dragged into these feuds between families unwillingly, and they were fighting very hard, both families, to make sure that their particular view of the events was correct. Listeners might be interested in a noxious weed case. You'd only get that in the Australian rural scene. We acted for a grazier who was being prosecuted by the local shire council for noxious weeds. And usually what happens in those cases, the poor old grazier goes in and nods the scone and gets a fine and is rapped on the knuckles and told don't do it again. But in this particular instance, our client defended it. He wanted to defend it. And we thought that he had a reasonable case. And this sort of caught the imagination of the local media and the press and one thing and another. Nobody had ever defended one of these cases. Anyway, we won it, which was a bit of a surprise even to me, I can tell you. We won the case. And that one case led to the council changing their lawyer from the lawyer that did the prosecution. They switched all their business to our firm out of that one noxious weeds case, which was amazing. The other one is I was acting down at Tamworth when I was helping the ALS, Aboriginal Legal Service, and I was doing a locum for them. And there was this guy who was an Aboriginal chap who was arrested and in custody overnight because he'd breached his bail. And for those of you that don't know, Quirindi is about 40 kilometres south of Tamworth, but the lockup was in Tamworth. So the police officers brought him up overnight and he was put in the lockup and he was before the court first thing the next morning. Now, the story was he was on a bond and one of the conditions of his bond was not to go into licensed premises. Now, he'd been out tar patching. This is in summertime. He was on what they call a CDB program. It was this program that was set up by the government where the government gives the local councils money targeted for the employment of Indigenous. And this guy really liked this job. He liked it. He was getting good money, much better than on the dole. And He was very, very proud that he had a visi vest. Now, you and I might think that that's a bit trivial, but for him, that was a sign that he was working and he was doing a difficult job. He knew people said it was a difficult job, but he was doing a job that he liked. Anyway, he got home from this particular afternoon of the offence, took the truck into the depot, and he was walking back to his home, regrettably, past the bowling club, which was on the edge of town, and he thought he'd duck in and have a schooner. Only the one. He only had the one schooner. And of course, you know, the Bolt Gendarmes, which is French for the local police, were driving past and they saw him coming out of the bowling club. They immediately arrested him and they drove him all the way to Tamworth and breached him because of what he'd done. And that is to say, he had been into licensed premises. So he couldn't argue that he hadn't. The magistrate was very annoyed. He was Magistrate McPherson was very, very sympathetic towards Indigenous people. He was very, very annoyed that this had happened. And he dealt in a very curt manner with the prosecutor and waived the breach. The difficulty then was how to get him back to Quirindi. There's no bus service or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, that is a problem.
And he was desperate. He kept saying to him when we first went into the cells to see him, make sure you ring the shire engineer and tell him what's happened. I don't want to lose my job. I'm, you know, with his visi vest. And he was in his visi vest in court. And anyway, fortunately, the Aboriginal Legal Service was able, through the field officer, to drive him back to the depot at Quirindi, and he got back on the job. But it was just one of those examples of very poor police work. And we then learnt that the coppers that brought him over spent all night in Tamworth. So really, their shift was wasted by them just sitting in the Tamworth police station, which again is not really good police work and very annoying. And the magistrate was all very annoyed. Everybody was very annoyed about the whole way. Even the prosecutor was annoyed. Good policing would have meant, come on, you know you shouldn't be doing that. Jump in the car and we'll drive you home. And that's one of the harshnesses that you have to deal with.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us, Paul.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. We want to hear from you. Please fill out our survey in the link below.